Let's have a meeting. My name is Mickey and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
My name is Danella and I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on the AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." So I'm excited to introduce our speaker tonight. I actually heard her before I saw her. We were at a midnight meeting up in Gainesville. I had about 40 days sober at that point. I had just gotten out of treatment and moved down here. And somebody wisely said to me, "Listen to the women and pick a sponsor who has what you want." And at that point, I knew I needed this. Not for a day, not for a month, not for a year, but I needed this for my life. Because I knew, the doctors told me that I was 18 minutes away from dead when I took my last drink. And I had a counselor tell me, "You really want to have another one and take a chance that the big man's not busy with somebody else for that 18 minutes? So I knew I just needed to find a way to do this and find a woman who was doing this in her life. And we were at a midnight meeting up in Gainesville. And at the end of the night, you know, those are always a little more intimate. Sometimes people share a little bit more when it's dark and you can really just share. And at the end of that meeting, when they were passing out chips, they got to the blue chips, and this woman stood up with 25 years sober, and I heard her speak, and honestly, the hairs on everywhere in the back of my neck just stood up, and I said, "I want what this woman has. She's got an energy about her, and she's doing this deal." And I am so grateful that for the last, coming up on 18 years, I have been able to follow her and learn from her. And I'm so excited to have brought her down here tonight so that she can share. And that some of you might say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." So I introduce Joan M.
Good evening. I am Joan M., and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a common drunk. I have found recovery, and it is amazing when you stop trying to control the world and you leave it up to God to do it for you, amazing things happen. So tonight I'm going to share with you briefly, hopefully it will be brief, my life, what it was like, what happened to me to bring me to alcoholism, and the path I've taken in recovery. So, if I was born June the 25th, 1933, and as of this past week, I turned 86. So, most of that has been in recovery, and I'm so grateful for that. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. In the late 30s and early 40s, there were rarely children who were from divorced parents. But I had a father and a mother for the first 8 years of my life. And there were five of us in the family, and my father was very religious. Every time the church doors were open, we were there. And I found out much later in my life, because we lived in Newport News, Virginia, and my father and mother were from a little town in what I call Lower Alabama. It's like 18 miles from the border of Alabama and West Florida. So I never knew any of my family. I never knew anything about my ancestors. But I'm a genealogist, and I've done a lot of tracing of the family, and I found out that there was a lot of alcoholism in the family. There was a lot of religious ministers in the family. So we had both people who knew God and people who thought they were God. And I was one of them. I can say that because I thought I knew everything. Just a quick example, the third night I was in an AA meeting right here at NABBA Club. I lived like 2 miles from here. So I was at NABBA Club, and I was reading Shakespeare, sitting at a table reading Shakespeare, waiting for the meeting to start. And this person came up to me and said something, and I started telling them all about AA. I knew everything about it. And this was only my third night in the meeting. I thought I had the message, but it's taken 43 years for me to get the message and to be able to share it with you. So that's what I want to do tonight. I grew up in Newport News. My father worked in the shipyard there, and he was poisoned with lead-based paint, and he was a small man, 5 feet 7 inches and 125 pounds. So he could go into the bowels of the ships and into the very bottom of them where the pipes were all there and do the spraying of lead-based paint on the pipes or painting the pipes. There was very little ventilation, and he developed real problems with his breathing and with his brain. And he would work, and then he would become very depressed and sick, and he would become suicidal, and he would become aggressively angry with everyone. And so we learned to stay out of his way when he was having an episode like that. My mother was very frightened of him and tried to protect us, but it got really bad. And one morning, my mother sent my older sister to school and said, "Get off the bus and call your aunt and tell her to come because it's dangerous here today." And when my aunt arrived, Dad had a butcher knife at her neck and had told her to say her prayers because he was going to finish her life right there in the kitchen. And with my four-year-old brother in the kitchen with them, my sister got off the bus, my aunt got there in time, and she ran to the door and left my brother in the house, and she ran for her life. He was put in the mental hospital in Williamsburg, Virginia, and he was there, and we could visit him, and we did go to visit him. And I remember being in the room with him, and he said, "How are you?" I said, "I'm tired." He said, "I'm tired too. I have been dragging the USS America, which was a luxury liner, back and forth across this room all night long, and I'm worn out." Now, it was 3.5 city blocks long. and he had no reality of what he was saying. We grew up with that kind of dysfunction, but then he left and went back to Bonifay, to his hometown, and it was better for him. The weather was better for him, and he went back to the farm and lived there. That was when all of this happened, when I was 8. And of course, that year I didn't pass my grades at school. I was a little anxious, and I didn't finish school, the work that year, and I had to repeat the third grade. My twin sister was promoted, but when she got to the fourth grade, I was not with her, and I was the dominant of the two twins, and so she asked if she could come back and be in the third grade with me again, because she didn't want to be separated. And we weren't. We stayed in the same grade every year until we got to high school, and I made a decision that I wanted to go to college. And she made a decision she wanted a business education, and we went our separate ways in high school. But life was very traumatic. And my twin sister would tell everybody that we had no father. He was dead. It was kind of difficult when he showed up a few years later, and was very much alive. But we all had our stories, and we all tried to deal with life however we could, and it was not always the same. But I learned very early to create stories about my life, and so one of the processes in being in AA is to learn what was reality and what was imagination, and to stick with the reality. It'll get you a long way if you're truthful and honest, even if you're ashamed of your past, which I was very guilty about. And I think a lot of my drinking was to cover up that shame. But anyway, I grew up, I went to work in the shipyard. I worked for 4 years there, saved my money. Not really. I saved some money. I bought a lot of clothes and things like girls do when they first get a job. But I knew I didn't want to work in the shipyard all my life, so I saved enough money to go away to school. I went to William and Mary College in Williamsburg. It was interesting. I was living in the same town where my father had been in the mental hospital, and just a few blocks from the hospital. But I was at William and Mary, and I was studying, and I decided I wanted to be a school teacher. I was taking history as my major, and then I realized I could go to school at a teaching college in the Valley of Virginia for about half the price I was paying at William and Mary, maybe a third of the price. So I transferred to Madison College in the Valley, and I graduated. I didn't graduate there. I had met my husband in high school. He was a member here. He was in this club with us. I can say that because this is the first time I've told my story since my husband passed away. He was always sitting here to correct me. And they would always have him speak the next week. And he said, I'll tell you the real story next week, with the things she left out. But anyway, I met him in high school. We dated all through high school. He went on to medical school. And we had to get through the first 2 years of medical school before we could get married. So I I dropped out of my college work to marry him, and we got married, and I taught school with a provisional teaching certificate. I didn't have my degree, but I had 2.5 years of college, and they needed a lot of teachers in the counties that were the rural counties of Virginia, so I could teach just outside of Richmond while he was in medical school, and that's what I did for 2 years. And then we went to Utah, to the University of Utah, for his residency. I kept taking classes. When I was in Richmond, I was teaching in the daytime, going to school at night. And when I went to Utah, I had a baby and went to school at night, and just taking one class at a time out in Utah. And that's the first place in Utah where I had to have a license that said I was a consumer of alcohol. If you wanted to buy alcohol in Utah, you had to have a driver's license-like card that showed that you consumed alcohol, and that was okay. So I got that very quickly. I had my first drink when I was 19. I had just finished high school, and I went to a party with my husband's best friend, had a fishing shack out on the Pecosin River there in Virginia, and we went to it, and I had never had an alcoholic drink. My mother had never had it in the house, and so I didn't know what to ask for. He said, "I'm giving you a bee's knee," and I said, "What is that?" Well, it turned out to be bourbon and with the water and a little bit of honey. And I liked it. I liked it, and I felt guilty because I was drinking, and that was a no-no in my family, and especially a no-no with a father like I had who was crazy. And so but I enjoyed it. And when I got to Utah, I was away from my mother and anybody that knew me, and I got that card that said I could drink as much as I wanted, and I started doing that. I was able to successfully drink without blacking out, passing out, or throwing up, and that went on for a number of years. I started having trouble, though. I did have blackouts in Utah, and I was only there 2 years. But I had blackouts when I drank. And I thought that was good because that was the only time my mind stopped racing and I could be relaxed. I felt like whatever I was going to do, I had to do with alcohol. And it was my best friend. I drank daily. Not in Utah. In Utah, I only drank when I went out. I didn't serve alcohol every day, but I did at every party, had to have alcohol at the parties. And I had a lot of parties and enjoyed that. And my life had some order in it. We moved from Utah. My husband had to go into service. He had been, deferred. While he was in medical school and while he was getting his internship, his residency, and he was studying to be an internist. And he got an order from Newport News to report for duty in the Army, or he would be January the 3rd of his first year of residency. He would have to come home to Virginia and go into the Army. And he said, "I don't want to just be passing out aspirin to people, so I'm going to find some service. They said, find a service you want to go into or you're going to get put in jail. I mean, not put in jail. You're going to be put in the army. He thought of it as jail. So anyway, he found out that there was a place called CDC in Atlanta, and they would accept him for 2 years as his military duty. So he came in as a young lieutenant in the U.S. Public Health Service with the idea of doing the 2 years and then going back to Utah and finishing his residency. And he retired at 32 years there as a rear admiral. So he had a good life, and I had a good life. We moved to Atlanta in 1961. It was a great town to be in at that time. It was booming. Everything was being built, a skyscraper, what I thought of as skyscrapers, because in Newport News, everything was on the 5 inches from the water level, and the tallest building was 2 stories. You could only have 2 stories on the sand. And so Atlanta had skyscrapers. We would go up in the bubble, the blue bubble, and have dinner. We'd go up there for cocktails. My husband was traveling all over the world. He was the first 2 years we were here, he went around the world 3 times. I stayed home raising children. But we had lots of people from all over the world coming to CDC, and we would entertain them. Of course, it was the drinking, lots of drinking. I just enjoyed it, and I didn't think I had a problem. I just had some nights that I didn't get through without passing out. I would wake up and not remember if I had cooked dinner. I'd have to go out and look at the grill to see if I had served dinner, if there were dishes in the dishwasher, because I did a lot in blackouts. You know, I just didn't remember after 7 o'clock. And I didn't think that was the problem. I didn't realize that you don't do those things. But I, along with all the success of life being in this flow of important things that really fed my ego, there was also the nights that I couldn't remember, the waking up with the dread that I'd done something wrong, driving under the influence, like after drinking all night and running out of booze. There was nothing wrong with getting in the car and driving 2 or 3 miles to the liquor store to get more, or needing cigarettes, because I was a heavy smoker as well. And so I never thought I had a problem. But I'm going to tell you now about some of the problems, so the way my drinking was, so that you can relate to it rather than saying I drank a lot. I went out to a dinner party. We had to wait 9 months to get to Nikolai's Roost for dinner. 9 months reservation. It was for my birthday. I went with my husband. We had this wonderful dinner. I dressed in a long evening gown. Everything was perfect. I woke up at two in the morning. They closed the beer hall where I was in Atlanta. It could stay open till 2 in those days. And we found that place, and we, after Nikolai's Roof, we stayed there till they closed. And somehow on the way home, I passed out. Another time we were at Fort McPherson. My husband had been promoted to another job at CDC, and we were having a farewell to the part that he had been running, and all these people were there in the new part, which was the VD, TB, rat control, and lead-based paint control. And I bought this fancy lace outfit to wear, and I had spent hours getting my hair all done up in this big poof. It was the 70s, all done up in this great bullet-like thing on my head with three hair pieces worked into it because I have thin hair. Well, we danced all night, and I would come off the floor, and I was hot and sweaty, and I was drinking martinis. We knew we were going to drink, so we didn't drive. We had a limousine come and pick us up, and they were going to take us home then at the end of the evening. We had learned we couldn't drink and drive, so we had limousine service. They carried me out of the limousine into the house because I was just out. The next day I couldn't find a couple of the pieces of hair, and they called me and said, "We found something you left in the back seat of the car." I was passed out in the back seat. And so they came out, made a special trip to the house to bring me my hair pieces that had fallen out off my head. Now, you asked me to tell this story. When I would drink, the old nightmares would come back, and I would be terrified. Terrified to go to sleep, terrified to be where I was. And as a child, I always tried to find a place that was safe and secure. I wanted to be safe. And so I would go to a closet or behind a sofa or some hole that I could get into that would keep me alive. And so I would do this when these things happened, because I had a wonderful husband who became a bear when he was drunk. He became aggressive and abusive. I think I said something one night at the door, and he smashed my face and my glasses, and didn't even remember till the next day when he saw the condition of my face. So I would hide. I had to hide. And we lived in a two-story Georgian house, beautiful house. And off my bedroom was a window that went out onto the rooftop of my den. And it was 8 more feet up to the top of the house, to the roof of the house. I managed to get up, go out the door. Now, I was drunk. I'd been drinking all evening. He was drunk, and I needed to get away from him. So I went out the roof, and there was a drain pipe there for that 8 feet. Somehow, I climbed the drain pipe, and I was on the top roof of the house, stumbling all around on the top of this. It was 3 stories down to the sidewalk, to the driveway. And I'm up there drunk and on the top of the house, running around in my nightgown at like 2:30 in the, maybe later than that. But anyway, the neighbors, I was an important person. I was a teacher in DeKalb County. I was married to a doctor, and an important doctor, somebody with a lot of knowledge and a lot of being respected by the citizenry, but here I am screaming around, being abusive, using language that my mother would wash my face and soap my mouth with soap for that kind of language. But I was there. But I was up there on the rooftop screaming and hollering and expecting my neighbors to understand that. I mean, I had the right to be that way. I mean, after all, what he had done to me, you know, he probably told me he didn't like dinner or something. But anyway, I was as sick as I could be. I was as sick as anybody that I called sick. I had a favorite place out in the backyard, which was under a canoe. The canoe was by the creek that ran through the backyard, and I would go out there and get under the canoe, and he could never find me. He would spend hours walking around in the backyard trying to find me while I huddled under this cold canoe. But I had my hiding places. I went to my doctor and I told him I thought I had a problem with drinking. He said, no, you have a problem with your husband and your childhood, and you need some therapy. If you understand your life and understand what's going on, you won't drink. And so I did that route. I didn't let them give me medications because I was up medicating myself. I didn't need this. And I was afraid I would become addictive if I started on medication. So, but I did spend 3 years going to a therapist, and it was like $67 an hour for 45 minutes. And I would go sometimes at 9 a.m. and be there till noon, talking about my life and my father and beating on pillows and doing all kinds of crazy things to try to deal with the problems in my life, because I did not want to be an alcoholic. I did not want to be labeled that, and I did not want to give up my best pal, which was that drink. And I drank gin, and I drank it straight. I drank alcohol. I hated the taste of beer, but I could put down. I'd get it at the military, that 3.6, and so I drank twice as much of it. And I would drink 2 6-packs at a time. And I had special wine that my husband didn't like because he wouldn't touch it. And I drank wine, I drank beer, I drank whatever was in front of me. To the point that we started making our own wine. We started making our own beer. And we were saving all that mess that comes off the beer to make brandy. One night, he had been in India, and there was no alcohol over there, so he had had 6 weeks of not drinking, and he came home and he didn't want to drink. And we had some people come over for his birthday, and they brought wine, and a bottle of wine for his birthday. We started with that. We drank that. We drank everything that was in the house, and we were considering taking those leads, that mess that comes off the scum and all that comes off the pan when you make the beer or wine. We were going to drink that because there was alcohol in it. And we had finished all the alcohol in the house, so that was what we ended up doing. Just swallowing that mess that had been sitting under the kitchen sink for 6 weeks waiting to be made into brandy. There wasn't enough, and I can say this, one drink was too much for me, and there was not a room big enough to hold what I needed. I'm going to leave out our life in England, except to tell you that I went to England, and that's when I crossed over from drinking and occasionally having, you know, drinking and being admitting to having blackouts, to where I drank daily. I drank from the time I got up in the morning till I passed out. Then I got up after that and drank some more. And I lived to drink, and I drank to live. And it was no longer working for me. It didn't give me that high. It just gave me the miseries, but I could not drink. There wasn't a time that I could go without drinking. And the thought of giving it up was just terrible. When I came in here, I weighed about another 50 pounds more than I weigh right now. All my clothes had holes in them where I had smoked and dropped ash all over them. I had a constant yellow nicotine stain here from smoking. I had bloated. I was bloated, red-faced, close to 250 pounds, I guess, and came in here shaking, not able to sit down, not able to sit still, and terrified of what was going to happen to me. But at the same time, sitting around thinking I had to read Shakespeare in these meetings, I had to let somebody know that I was a quality person. I really knew the bad side of me and was terrified that somebody would see that and discover just how bad I was. I thought to give up drink would be to die. And so I was continuing and willing to kill myself. And in fact, I tried to do that. I was going to kill myself one night. I was just so tired of living. And I got the scissors out, and I had a butcher knife on the table. And, I mean, that was a regular thing. When Donald and I got into a fight, he might break a bottle and come at me, and I had a butcher knife. And here we are, quality people. You know, he's passing out the bread and wine at the communion table on Sundays, and we are at each other's throats with butcher knives and broken bottles. Talk about schizophrenic. That's what our life was. So I was going to kill myself, and I couldn't do it. I was looking. I no longer watched brushing my teeth. I would not look in my eyes because I knew that would show me what I was like on the inside. So I looked anywhere except in my eyes, but I got it in there to kill myself in the bathroom. And I ended up taking the scissors and chopping all my hair off. As I talked, "You are no good. You're a damn bad person. You're this, that, and the other." The next day, I had to live with being bald-headed. I got in the car. I put a kerchief around my head, and I went to the shopping center and bought 3 wigs. I told them that I had had a permanent, and they used too many chemicals, and my hair all got just melted, and I had to shave my head. I could not be honest about anything. But I came in here and they said you have to be honest and you have to start being really careful about what you say and mean what you say. And if you don't know what to say, shut up. And they told me, you're not allowed to speak at all. You come to the meetings and you say, tell us you're an alcoholic, and then listen. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. Sit there and listen, and you might learn something about yourself. So I was afraid of what I was going to learn, but I had no options. I was down to even trying to kill myself wouldn't work. So there was no place to go but to AA. And I thought it was the very last thing and the worst thing. And it became the best thing in my life, and it became the most successful thing in my life. One day at a time, 1 hour at a time, sometimes 15 minutes at a time, I shook my way through the first month. I picked up my 30-day chip here. I picked up my six-month chip here. I came to this place every day when I sent my kids to school and there was nothing for me to do. I was, I'm not capable of teaching at that point. So I would get up and get my clothes on and brush my teeth and come to NABBA Club. And they had a room downstairs with breakfast. I could have breakfast here. I could have lunch here. I could attend the 11 o'clock meeting. And I came on a regular basis every day I was here. For instead of the 90 days that you're supposed to try to do 90 and 90, I did 110 in the 90 days. And before I knew it, they had me passing out, getting up and reading something, even though I was shaky. They did let me do that, but I was to keep my mouth shut in the meetings. And so I learned to do that, to listen. And some of the old-timers said, how long have you been in the meetings? And I said something, and this man said, well, she's been here longer than I have. He had a month more than I did. But I was here so often that they just thought I was an old-timer. And that gave me a little bit of hope. And I met people like Danella. I met people who had time in the program. There was some wonderful, Bill Roop was my husband's grandfather's sponsor, and we just stuck with the winners. We sat in these seats and we listened and we learned. And now here I am coming up on 44 years in December, and I can't believe it. I've had a life. I've learned to live and enjoy life, and life is a bitch. It can be. It can really be. They call it in here. What did I tell you on the way over here? My mind is going. something in lump. Lumps in the road.
Bumps in the road.
That's what. They're bumps in the road, and they hit you daily. You don't know when they're going to come. It blindsides you like football when somebody hits you from the side, and you're flat before you know it. And so what you have to do is trust God. He has all of the answers. And I knew a God. I knew the God of my childhood. I knew the God that I was terrified of, the one that was going to really do me in. But I didn't have a personal relationship with the God of my understanding. And for that, I'm grateful to AA. That's where I learned about a God who loves me, who has all the answers, and is just waiting to give those answers to me. All I have to do is come to Him, trust Him, trust in the good order of this program, that God's good order is here, and it's those 12 steps, the 12 traditions, it's taking it daily. It's no big deal, you know, no matter what the deal is. The night they told me my husband had like just hours to live, I was terrified. He had been suffering for 9 months, and he had now just a few hours to live. I got in touch with Danella. She drove to my house. She took me to a meeting, and I was sitting in that meeting saying, we were supposed to have 40 years next month, but he's not going to make it. But his other request was to die sober, and that's going to happen. And this man was in the meeting. He had never been there before. And he said, I drove around and around looking for this storefront meeting. And he said, that lady is telling it like it is. She's got something to face, and she's going to get prepared by turning it over to God and letting Him do it for her. She's admitting she can't go through this, but she's got to walk through it, and she's going to walk through it with God, the God of her understanding. When the meeting was over, he came up to me and he said, I picked up my 40-year chip this just a month ago. And he said, I'm going to give this to you to hold until you get yours. I said, no, I'm not going to hold it. I'm going to take it home to my husband and give it to him. He died with the chip in his hand. He had 3 days with that chip in his hand, and I buried him with the chip in his hand. That's what this program can do for you. No matter what you have to face in life, in death, every need will be met. Every requirement to get you through it is here. It's all been prepared, and all you have to do is open your hands and receive it. God is willing if you call upon Him. And I found that God, that personal relationship with a God, a higher power, greater than me, greater than the combination of any me's I could put together. He is there and available to you. So just remember it when the hard bumps or lumps or whatever come in life, to walk through it with your head high and the gratitude, thanking God for what He has done for us. I never knew what a pathway this would be, but it has been a joy to be a recovering alcoholic. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. Appreciate your story. It was very nice. We've asked Preston to come up and hand out the chips.
My name is Preston. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, Preston. We give out chips to mark our various lengths of sobriety. First chip that we offer is the white chip. This is for anyone that has 24 hours of desire to stop drinking.
come were strange to me. As I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down. Right now feels like it's killing me. Life out here gets so depressing. Need something to take the edge